Call today's midday planning commission into session. Thanks for all the staff and fellow commissioners here. Everyone is here except for Mr. Gates, Mr. Smith, and Mr. McCormick, who are excused. Thanks, Lynette, for putting lunch together for us and for all the administrative work you do. And we can go ahead and get started. Short agenda item today. Please get approval of the agenda.
I'd like to make a motion to approve the agenda.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Next, we have approval of the minutes from our June 22nd meeting.
I will make a motion to approve the minutes.
I'll second.
Most seconds, seeing no discussion, call for a vote. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? And it is passed. And with our short agenda, I did not see, do we have any correspondence or was attached to our agenda?
No correspondence was received.
Okay. Now's the time for our general public comment. If there's anyone here.
Wait, update.
Oh, yeah, to skip that. I was
update
not here.
And Mr. McCormick is here. A happy surprise.
Yes, Mr. Stone.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And commission members. As mentioned last month, I'm going to begin noting when council consistently tracks with the planning commission recommendations. And that is also the case once again in this month's items. So I just wanted to make that a note when that occurs. For consent motion approvals, we have the six pump stations for the Mount Pleasant Water Works, all within PDs. 210 Lucas, pump station 15, did come in for design review approval and is approved. I know that was brought up as a question last month. We also consent motion approval for 110 Pitt, the rezoning from neighborhood commercial to R4, allowing those improvements to go ahead. The approval for first reading for the Central Mount Pleasant PD. It was approved with the conditions that were recommended and aggregating that 2.3-acre tract that abuts the PD and the mixed-use center. And the approved impact assessment for the Highway 17 Retail Village. It was approved with the conditions of the 100-foot buffer. And also the Live to Play PD, that will be coming back to you next month as council granted a waiver. And also be looking for short-term rental text amendments coming to you in August as well.
Any questions, Ms. Smith?
Yes, I do. On the pump stations that the Water Works is working their way through, is there a point person in the planning department that is tracking them? Because part of the rezone is with that rezone, they need to come into compliance with the ordinance that we have regarding pump stations. And is there a set time for them to get into compliance once they've got the new zoning?
So the point person would be design review staff, which would be me reviewing site and landscape. So I'll be tracking all those as they come in. And really, as you'll hear about today, they come in through the development review team process. So EDS is running, the engineering and development services is running that process. The submittals come in, I review it for the zoning code compliance, which all pump stations are conditional use.
Right.
So that's buffering, fencing, all those things I've been looking at. The compliance is not so much a time-based thing, it's more of when repairs are requested, then that triggers you to come into compliance.
So it's not the rezone that triggers the compliance?
A simple rezoning request just allows the designation to change. It's when they come in for repairs and request for maintenance. That's when the conditions then come into play.
Well, the reason why I'm bringing it up, the pump station, the famous one where we denied because nobody from the Water Works came to present, which is in kind of behind Page's Okra Grill, it's horrendous. I mean, it really is. So we have no way of, twisting their arm a little bit. And that's right in the middle of a residential neighborhood, as opposed to some of these pump stations, are come like a little parcel in the corner of a PUD or something like this.
Sure.
So what recourse do we have?
Sure. And I might have run through this a little bit too quickly, but as I mentioned, 210 Lucas, which is pump station 15, which is that pump station.
That's it.
I approved it last week for updated landscaping, fencing, and everything. So
you did?
I did.
So it is going to finally
it is.
Get some work
yes,
done.
Ma'am.
Thank you very much, Mr. Stowe.
Anyone else? Seeing none, we'll go to our general public comment. If there's anybody here that would like to speak, we do not have any public hearing items tonight. So if there's anyone like to speak, please just come up to the microphone, give your name and address, and we'd have 2 minutes. Seeing no one, we'll continue with the agenda and go to item 7A.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So this topic came up, I think, April Planning Committee. It was requested by the Planning and Development Committee to be put on the agenda. So staff put together some slides discussing what our current residential densities are in commercial districts. We talked about some of the guiding policies for that, what the comp plan calls for, and then we talked about some of our growth management plans in place right now, which are we still have a multifamily moratorium in place, which will expire, I think, early next year, and then we still have a building permit allocation system, which is in place until the end of 2024. And both of those things, we talked about the code rewrite too. We're in progress for the code rewrite, but both of those ordinances prohibit any sort of multifamily at this time, unless it's affordable housing or workforce housing. That's the only exemption. So we talked about that in April, and the committee, I think, took a motion on whether to move that forward to town council for further discussion or action. And at that time, it did not move forward. And then last month, we were asked to bring it to the commission for further discussion. So I've put together just a few more slides, and it's really to talk about what is in the comp plan, what do we have in our current code, what are we doing at this time, and what can be changed as we move forward. And so I'll just go through this, and we'll open it up for discussion.
Michelle, can I ask a quick question?
Yes, ma'am.
Could you give us the reason why Council and Planning Committee has decided? I mean, in other words, obviously they want something. And I'm not terribly interested in spending a lot of time tilting at windmills, you know, trying to guess, mm-hmm. nor, I don't, I mean, just give me a general idea. What are their concerns with the way it is now?
The only, what I've gathered is that right now you can do, I'll jump right to it. Right now in our commercial districts, it's a conditional use to do duplex dwellings, multifamily, right. and single-family dwelling. It's a conditional use up to 12 units an acre. It's my understanding that several council members believe that 12 units an acre is too high and we need to look at lowering it. And so I think that's really kind of the impetus for it. So it is currently conditional, subject to these three conditions. You can't have direct access to the street level. No residential uses can be on the same floor as non-residential, and then you can't exceed 12 units an acre. So that's what we currently have in place. And just to put it in context, these are our densities for residential districts. And these were amended last year to match the comp plan. And so you can see the highest density we have in our residential districts are Patriots Point Waterfront Gateway, which is 12 units an acre. Traditional residential neighborhood is 6. Our mixed neighborhoods is 9. And so that gives you an idea of what we have in our residential uses. So I just wanted to talk a little bit about what we have in place for the comp plan. The commercial districts in the comp plan are broken up into two sections. We call them hubs and then redevelopment centers. For the hubs, we have neighborhood scale and commercial scale. And then we have our redevelopment centers. So we have 8 hubs, community scale hubs, and then we have 2 redevelopment centers. And this is kind of how they're defined as far as and separated out. And the redevelopment centers, I'll get into that in just a minute. Those are our older commercial neighborhoods. And so these are the recommendations that came out of that section was just to create zoning that's comparable to the comp plan recommendations. and then look at special area plans. And we're going to be starting to do that this fall. So this is what is recommended for the community scale and redevelopment centers. And basically, like I said, we have 8 community scale hubs. The comp plan recommends that within those hubs, housing may account for 20% of the square footage of the development. It could be single family or multifamily. And then of that 20% square footage, workforce housing or senior housing will be required to be 30%. So 30% of the 20% is required to be workforce and senior housing. That requirement in the comp plan is still something that we are working with legal and talking about these things. Obviously, there are states where you can require affordable housing. That's a different subject, and we're still looking at that, but that's what the comp plan recommends for community scale hub. For the redevelopment centers, it says that housing may be single family attached or multifamily in mixed use buildings. It does limit the maximum number of units to be 1 unit per developable acre. Again, we have 2 redevelopment centers, and then it says that this can only be achieved through a town council adopted plan development. So that's what the comp plan recommends for that area. So these little black arrows pointing to the bigger circles, those are our 8 community scale hubs. So if we were to change the commercial areas that are zoned commercial within those hubs, we would go back to that 20% square footage, and then the 30% of that would be the workforce housing. And obviously these hubs are circles. They're not, we have them defined on another map, but that gives you an idea of what that would mean for the commercially zoned properties within those areas.
Michelle?
And then we have, Michelle, yes, ma'am.
Just to clarify for the people that don't look at the comp plan as often as I do, going back mm-hmm. for a second, those
yes.
big circles are just gateways. Those have nothing to do with whether they're hubs, the big, big circles. It's the arrows that go to the little wagon wheels that are the commercial, I mean, that are the community scale hubs.
Right. The community scale hub is the
little
the wheel.
Arrows. Right.
Right.
I'm just saying those big blue circles are there
oh,
as
those
gateways.
Are gateways.
Those
Correct.
Are not really part of this conversation.
Correct.
I
right.
just wanted to
right.
let people know.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Thank you. So this is one of the redevelopment centers. Going back on the last slide, the redevelopment centers are recommend. Yes, ma'am. Do you have a question?
No.
Oh, okay.
I'm trying to guess where it was.
That, Houston Northcutt.
That's
yeah.
Houston Northcutt, right?
Yeah.
That's where Whole Foods is, that whole.
Yeah.
Right.
So again, these two, this is one of our 2 redevelopment centers. Again, that's recommended for 1 unit per developable acre, and with the percentage of that being affordable or workforce housing. Just a rough measurement of this, it appeared to be approximately 210 acres. That's not developable. That was just a rough GIS measurement. And then our second development, redevelopment center is at the 17 I-526 corridor. That was roughly 410 acres.
Yeah, that includes Midtown. And
Midtown?
Midtown's just outside.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah, okay.
And then we hear a lot about what, you know, planners like to do the visual preference. Do you like this or do you like this? Well, we hear a lot about what we like, what we don't like. So I just threw a few of our existing neighborhoods in here to give you an idea of what it looks like when we're talking about density. So on the low end, we have Riviera at Seaside. A lot of people like the layout of Seaside Farms. It's a big mixed-use neighborhood. As far as Riviera and the mixed-use track, there are 5 separate parcels where the multifamily is scattered throughout for a total of 276 residential units, and it's on 45 acres, so it's about 7 dwelling units per acre for that entire development. Shelmore Village has 41 residential units on 3.6 acres, and we always round up, so that comes out to 12 units an acre, which is what this is the neighborhood that was approved and planned under the AB density was 12. So this is a perfect example of what we have in place now and what we ended up with.
So
yes, sir.
How does that translate to square footage for those units? Do you have a sense for that? Just
I'm not sure what the size are of Shelmore Village, and I don't know if you can even recall going through DRB. Yeah, I would have to get that information for you.
Just curious, I'm trying to visualize, you know, how many persons that would accommodate, you know?
Right.
Those ones I know.
Yeah.
Those are, they are single units.
Units above the commercial.
So it's, in other words, you've got first floor is...
Commercial.
Commercial,
right.
Thank you.
And then
it is one unit above.
Above that, yeah.
So it's, I'm guessing it's 1,000 square feet-ish?
Probably closer to...
I think at least, yeah. It's definitely larger, yeah.
There are two floors of residential.
Yes, yeah.
So I'm guessing you're talking 2 to 4 people?
Yeah.
Thank you, appreciate it, it helps you a lot.
Yeah.
While we're on that picture, what is allowed on, we mentioned, and I thought we tightened it up a couple years ago, is allowed on the first floor? What do we consider business? Could it be?
I think right now, the it calls for ground floor retail, I think is what it calls for.
Okay, so
and so anything that meets our definition, and I, you can...
Like NC or...
Yeah.
Office professional, like that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And those two that you've shown so far, those are community hubs, community scale hubs, Seaside and Shelmore.
Correct. And then the last one is a little bit higher. That's Oyster Park mixed use. That is 269 residential units on 13.57 acres. And that comes out to about 20 units an acre, which wouldn't be allowed today. So that's kind of...
That's completely built out, isn't it, Oyster Park?
Yeah. Yeah, I think they're filling the more of the commercial now, but it is built out. So that's kind of what I have for you now. And I'd like to just open it up for discussion. Again, we currently allow 12 units an acre, if you're commercial, as a conditional use. And we are in the middle of a code rewrite. And so, again, I think the concern is that 12 was too high for a commercial district. And so that's what we have in our comp plan now. That's what it recommends. And I'll just open it up for discussion.
Ms. Arledge, we'll start down there.
My concern, and I think the concern of some of the council members that I've spoken to about this, is the difference between the hubs and the rest of the commercial corridors. And I think, having worked a lot on the comp plan over those years, there is a good reason for the hubs. You know, they're clusters of commercial and mixed-use development, and they're intended to sort of be a bigger concentration to serve the immediate surrounding areas and to be more of a live-work shop kind of a place. The concern that I have is that if we start allowing, or if we continue to allow, 12 residential units per acre for all of that pink, which is, I think the pink is all the commercial area along the commercial corridors, and not more sort of clustered, we're basically eliminating the value or the purpose of the hubs, in my opinion. I think we're sorting, we would allow, let's say I were a developer and I bought up several acres of commercial space not in one of those hubs, and I wanted to get the most money, most bang for my buck, because I think they make a lot more on residential than they do on commercial, and the town makes less. It worries me that we're then going to be sort of cannibalizing our commercial spaces and having many more residential units in a much more sprawled environment, as opposed to the clustered hubs. I love the idea of keeping the hubs as they are, you know, keeping them as hubs, and then keeping more sort of single commercial uses for the other pink areas.
You mean having no residential?
Well, or having a small. I can see the idea of having like a mom and a pop, you know, you build a store and then you want to live above it, or you have a couple.
Ironically, that was the thinking behind the ones off, you know, right south of Ion that we looked at, the Shelmore.
Yeah.
Because, in other words, but I could run my wine shop and live above it.
That is a hub because it's a larger acred area. But let's say I just had, you know, a half an acre. Rather than throwing 6 units in there because it's a half an acre or 12 in an acre, I could see we should have something, some small amount for if somebody wants to put, you know, an apartment above a store or an office. So I mean, none would be fine with me, but I'm just saying, I'm not saying it has to be an all or nothing, but 12 per acre is a lot. It makes sense for...
The hubs.
The huge hubs, because the acreage is so big.
So it strikes me that the town for a while has, you know, they give lip service to workforce housing, you know, to senior housing. And it strikes me that, so I hear what you're saying, Pam, mm-hmm. but it strikes me that the best way to kind of accomplish those objectives is through allowing residential within commercial zoning. Generally speaking, they tend to be lower price points to begin with. I don't necessarily, I mean, to me, 30% of the 20% is kind of a sop. Unless, I mean, I guess my rhetorical question is how serious really is town council about doing something about affordability? And it comes at a time, within the last, I'd say, 6 years, 10 years, the housing market in the United States has become monetized, and most people have not noticed it. The combination of very inexpensive money from the Fed, combined with extremely low yield rates in your usual financial instruments. So what you had is you had the creation of all these REITs and private equity firms. Either they're doing one of two things. They're buying houses and turning them into rentals, or they are putting up their own apartment buildings, like MetLife over off of Harry Holman, and they're holding on to it, and they're getting a yield, but it's driving up the price of everything. So if you look at what rental rates are in the Charleston area, they are way higher than they really should be.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm not saying, all I'm saying is town council really needs to decide whether or not they're going to do something about workforce housing. And they don't have to. There are a lot of communities around the country that just say this is what we are. You know, you've got places like Greenwich, Connecticut. They are a bedroom community in New York City. And they're very, very limited.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so.
Can I ask you a question? I mean, I know we shouldn't go back and forth, but I just have a question.
Question.
If you're suggesting that the other, outside the hubs, if residential would be okay so long as it's workforce housing and not just going to be more expensive apartments or condos that are
exactly.
sold, that assuming the legality of it is cleared up, because I know that still is a question, that to me makes sense, because I don't think that's going to incentivize developers to like go crazy over workforce housing. If you want to have a couple of places and you're going to, you know, I think that incentivizes the right things and not the wrong things for developers in terms of,
mm-hmm.
I wouldn't want to just fill in density in every commercial space with more places that charge $2,500 for a one-bedroom apartment.
Well, anything that we've done in the past, in my opinion, was just a boon to developers, because what we would say is, oh, we'll give you increased
bonus.
Density.
Yeah,
we'll give you bonus density
right.
if you put in some workforce housing. Oh, yes. Oh, and it's going to expire in 7 years or 10 years or whatever it is. It's a joke. And that's, you know, and that was a backroom deal, in my opinion.
The one thing I think we need to look at also is the fact that the definition of workforce housing, I believe, is 10 year. It's a 10-year obligation in what we have in our ordinance, right?
But we...
Yeah, that's what our current ordinance says, a minimum of 10 years.
That's
the
short.
One that we just approved, they signed on for
yeah.
35 years.
No, I think the 30, one, yeah, I think it was
75.
75 yeah.
It was a long period of time,
right.
And they did that voluntarily.
Right.
Right.
Correct.
But the obligation is only for 10 years, huh. which is really needs to get raised to 20 or more.
Or 30.
Yeah, I agree, because 10 well, goes by like a blink of an eye.
Michelle, could you return to the density table? I'm trying to get a sense relatively of what's...
How we allow in our residential? Yeah.
The commercial isn't
So we don't have a density for commercial now at all?
Or the hubs in there?
No, because it's conditional.
Just the conditional, correct.
Correct.
So one option would be for us to establish one at some level, whatever we think we would recommend, I don't know.
Well, just change the condition.
Okay, so, well, I was just going to say, you add workforce housing as a condition, and I think that that is legal as long as it is 100% across a zoning.
Yeah, like all AB, not just this parcel or a couple of parcels.
David, could you comment on that? What's the state of the art right now with respect to, is there precedent for defining those kinds of parcels for a particular purpose like workforce?
Not much guidance, but I take the position, I think Ms. Smith said it correctly, as long as we apply it.
Okay.
Not spot zoning.
Right.
I think that's going to be the best way forward.
I see. So it's achievable, but with sort of broad application, right?
Right. We don't have the ability to point out a specific parcel and say that this is going to be workforce housing.
Understood.
So, Mr. Bennett, were you saying perhaps, if we go back to those conditions, the condition would be density number 3 or 4, we add a 4, and it would be only allowed, you're only allowed, if it's multifamily and not single-family or duplex, you're only allowed to do workforce housing? Or would it apply to any?
Well, I mean, it's a question.
Something like that.
I like Ms. Smith's suggestion regarding workforce housing. I think it's valid.
Effectively, you're not going to have single-family housing for workforce. It doesn't make sense economically for a developer.
Yeah, so maybe we separate out multifamily. So duplex and single family, it stays. Multifamily, it's subject to, it has to be.
And I would still lower the number.
And I think you could still, on this chart, vary the density. Like, in other words, 12 per acre, I think, is fine in those hubs.
Well, we already have hubs in the comp plan described on their own, like, you know, the certain amount of 30% or whatever
right.
it is.
Yes.
You don't need that. It's for the other than hubs.
It's a PD.
Yeah, so back to Pam's point, we're concerned about, you know, how much is too much and how much, at what point are you creating a de facto hub outside of the designated
hub? One long running hub.
And so I don't know what the number is. Maybe it's half. You know, it's six units. It's 4 units. I don't know.
And that they'd be workforce housing.
Right.
Or so would it be, you keep it at 12, it has to be workforce housing. If you don't do workforce housing, it's 6 or 9 or something like that. Or across the board has to be.
I think we workforce. Should incentivize to do workforce housing as much as possible. I would make it across the board. I would lower the 12 to, let's say, 6. Or just arbitrary. I mean, we're giving recommendations. We're not.
Exactly. I mean, If you think about it, I think most people in Mount Pleasant today think the town is big enough.
Mm-hmm.
So at this,
we don't really want to
at this point, why should we have any incentive
right.
in commercial properties to have residential at all? Unless it's, in my opinion, workforce or senior.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll push back a little bit because I do like, and maybe just because my experience a couple of weeks ago when, you know, in Europe, where I love the concept of people working on the ground floor and the people lived right above it. And we saw a lot over there.
Oh, yeah.
So I don't want to exclude, you know, a young entrepreneur that maybe can only afford a single family residence to consider something like that. Where did the 12 units per acre, is that just kind of across the board planning or was that just established by this town?
Published many years ago, before I came here.
Yeah,
it's just
as long as I can
what it's been.
The other thing that I just think we should throw into the conversation is that my understanding is that workforce housing is excluded from the moratorium and from the building permit allocation. The permit allocation.
Correct.
So there's no delay, you know, there's no exclusion in terms of being able to build.
Right.
So I think this is important to change right away because we're not looking at a waiting period, you know, before things take effect.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, regarding the building permit, that expires
2024.
January 2024.
And when, or what are the numbers? Are we butting up against it now, or is it?
There are no multifamily units.
So what's the density of the Winnowing Way workforce housing?
I'm sorry, of the what?
Winnowing Way workforce housing.
Gregory Ferry, that density, I'm not real sure. Yeah, it's part of a larger, Gregory Ferry as a whole is higher density, but just the one that recently came through with the workforce housing, that was 30-something units on 4 or 5 acres, I think. So.
Roughly like 6 per acre.
Yeah, it wasn't real high. It was about, yeah, about 6, so. So I'm hearing we change condition number 3 from 12 to maybe 6, and then we add number 4 that says must be workforce housing.
We do have the options, this is a discussion item 2, to have staff look at it too, some of the numbers, and provide a recommendation. Personally, I'd feel more comfortable with it and be able to look at it in more detail than just picking out 6, you know, or 7.
Right. Well, maybe the recommendation can be to reduce it to something around 6, and they'll look at it. But I'd hate to wait another month to get it back to the planning committee and council, you know, if maybe you could just look at the number.
I'd rather do it right the first time, you know, right, we look at it in more detail, and that's just, you know, that's just me, one vote, but.
Unless I am unaware of something, I'm not feeling this overwhelming sense of urgency. I mean, they started talking about this in April, and then they decided to send it here. Okay, well, we're being thoughtful as well.
Michelle, a question. When, I think I saw from one of the presentations, maybe to committee or council, I don't remember, that this was one of the first things that you and the consultants were addressing. Was that, did I misread that? Is that right?
Yeah, no, we're working on it now. We started with the, you know, definitions, acronyms, all of those things, and now we're into the districts and the densities and those sorts of things. So, but, I mean, if this is the direction we want to go, and if committee and council is on board with that, that's, you know, it's an easy fix.
It's an easy change, yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, we are working on, we're working on the residential districts right now, so.
Probably a difficult question to answer, but where is it believed the town has least availability in terms of, you know, living options from, you know, condominiums, owned, smaller owned parcels versus, you know, rentals versus single-family dwellings, all those options? Where, you know, where's the demand greatest, and where are we falling short in terms of, you know, building and providing opportunity for a broad array of persons to live in the community?
Good question. I think it appears that we're probably falling short throughout the town, yeah.
But at all levels, or just, that's the question. I didn't know what type of housing is we're falling shortest on, if we can even answer that. I mean, if I'm a real estate developer, would I, and I thought, and I was looking at, you know, our community, you know, from a very high level, where would they say, gosh, you know, developers heretofore have missed the mark with respect to this kind of opportunity? I don't know what that opportunity is, you know?
Yeah.
I would guess single-family slash townhome. Historically, people have wanted to move to Mount Pleasant, now, I mean, people that just moved to Mount Pleasant, but in terms of shifting within our area, people would move to Mount Pleasant when they had started a family, because they had the best public schools. I mean, in other words, if you didn't want to pay to send your children to Porter Gaud or Ashley Hall. A lot of people that I knew downtown, that was the shift. We've always been kind of a family-oriented town, which is why my guess is, single-family slash townhome, you know, the picket fence and the backyard for little boy to play in, all that.
I do think that we're seeing a little bit of a shift with, whether it's, you know, economic reasons, COVID, those sorts of things. We're seeing more maybe younger people come back and needing a place to live if they're not living with their family. And then, of course, the aging population. And that's one of the things we're looking at, too, with the based on the comp plan recommendations and the code rewrite is historically, everybody thinks you either have single family or multifamily, and it's called the missing middle housing, and that's what we're kind of working on as a recommendation from the comp plan. You know, is it appropriate to have a duplex on the corner instead of a large single family? And while it may not be affordable housing, it's going to be more affordable than a large single family. So those are some things that we are, and you'll be seeing that in the next couple of months in a draft form.
I mean, in all candor, what you described is the case of my adult children.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And some of that, too, you know, the thought was in 2010 when we adopted the ADU ordinance, the intent was to provide housing for kids, for aging parents, and those sorts of things. Well, we've seen we saw the shift for a while where they were rented. Some of them are used as short-term rental. But we're seeing more recently people wanting them for their parents and for their kids, for family members. And there's the moratorium. We're out of those until, I think, June or July of next year. Yeah. So, but we are seeing more people wanting them not to rent out, but for family.
Which, interestingly, for the life of me, I don't understand at all why we allow ADUs to be used as STRs.
I mean,
the only reason council was able to pass the whole ADU thing in the first place was the marketing of it was affordable. It was affordable housing.
Well, we'll have that public hearing in August, Ms. Smith, and we can
from here.
Can put that in the form
and
of
I
a
could
motion.
Come and speak as a citizen.
Michelle, I got a question for you.
Yes, sir.
General observation, just ballpark it. Would it be fair to say that Mount Pleasant is like 80% developed?
Oh, 90.
At least.
Yeah, I would say, I think Lynette was asking you to, you asked how much I would ballpark the town is developed. Yeah, I'd say more than 80. I think we're seeing, 90. Yeah, we're finishing up with the last phase of Carolina Park is going through.
See, I consider that
Liberty Hill Farms is done.
It's part of the PD. Exactly.
Yeah.
We agreed how many houses could be there.
In.
What yeah. kind of, you know, commercial, so.
So the two big ones, Carolina Park and Liberty Hill Farms, are done. So we're just seeing the little, you know, two lots into three, those sorts of things.
What about that Wando tract?
The Republic tract?
If that's what it's called.
On Highway 41? Yeah. I think it's still for sale, but it's in the county. They would have to, if that was the desire of the whoever purchased it and they wanted to come into the town, they would probably have to do some sort of plan development, which would come before you all and town council.
So do we have, and not putting you on the spot, but just thought I saw it before, a percentage of, before we look at making recommendations and changes and all that, of our town, what percentage is single family versus what percentage that we have duplexes versus apartments?
Oh, gosh.
I bet it's
I have that at my fingertips. It's pretty high. It's probably 70 to 80%. 70-30. Yep.
It's kind of close to national or recommendations, I guess, nationwide. Or do we?
I don't know about that. Mm. No. I don't know about that. But we've typically tracked around 70-30.
Something I think of, you know, before we make a recommendation, maybe if we do see it next time to look at it and make sure, you know, taking something out that we really need, that, you know, we are, like you talked about, missing the middle part,
mm-hmm.
To maybe to include it, to, you know, duplex or whatever you, I don't, you know, mm-hmm. just based on that data, it would be really good.
Yeah.
Well, duplex would not be changed, right? It would be, or would it be?
For this particular amendment here, it would be the multifamily that would drop down, and then the, I think, if that's what I was hearing.
Yeah, I mean.
Yeah, you wouldn't. But you'll be seeing with the comp plan or the zoning code rewrite, we'll be bringing that, and we'll be discussing the different types of the middle housing, triplex, duplex, those sorts of things.
All right, seeing if anybody else has anything. Mm-mm. Does anybody want to make a recommendation, or we want to see it again?
I mean, I would prefer that it go to committee, because I think they've been talking about it for, I think I've seen it on their agenda or talked about it for mm-hmm. several months, and then it's gone to council before. I would feel comfortable.
And this was just an item for discussion.
Yeah,
I don't think,
right. It's just recommendations.
I don't even think we need to make a motion.
No, we just need to give her recommendations.
Well, I guess my only hesitancy is, well, I agree with the concept totally. I think I'd be on board. I can't say for certain that the magic number of what, mm-hmm. when I change numbers, I would kind of like to have more information, data, or okay. to look at further for myself.
I agree.
I agree with you, Joseph.
And also because when you talk about legalities, my experience has been if you use numbers that have some connection to a reality somewhere, mm-hmm. it becomes justifiable. Well, we picked this number because, mm-hmm. as opposed to, I don't know, yeah. five sounds good.
So would you want to see more examples of what we have around town and maybe in other areas, what different densities look like? Is that what you're...
Yeah, I don't know. For is it possible that ULI or some other...
Yeah.
You know, national organization has provided similar data and examples, because this is very helpful, at least yeah. it is to me visually, and even if we had some square footage figures just to get a better sense for, you know, what those kinds of dwellings are like,
yeah.
that I think would better inform both us, but also council, too.
And that show more, I mean, actually, I think that is really attractive.
Me too, absolutely.
It is. If you drive through it, I mean, the way right. it's laid out
yeah.
and the way...
Very cool.
Yeah. It is. It's very
nice. And
the roads
are done in such a way that it's very traffic calming without having all sorts of speed bumps.
But it is a hub, and that's what I want to make a distinction between the hubs, which this is what the hubs should look like, versus the rest right. of the commercial corridors that could end up looking like one long, big thing like this. There's really has to be a distinction. Otherwise, the hubs are meaningless.
But the hub, this was there, and that's why it's a hub, though, right? Like, we came back and put it because it was already there. So if it wasn't there...
Well, we've already identified what
yeah.
the hubs, the community scale, and are or should be, you know, and so, and they are dispersed around town
right.
for that reason, because they serve, you know, a sort of a smaller, unlike the redevelopment centers, mm-hmm. they are serving areas of town more than they are others.
Well, are you able to look at the acreage
mm-hmm.
of these, of
the hubs?
Yes. We're talking about the community hubs, right? These smaller ones?
Where the large wheels.
That's where the black arrows are.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Those are the community hubs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, because it strikes me that if you want something that kind of looks like Shelmore, you're going to be able to kind of back your way into what the density is, right? I mean, in other words...
I guess what I'm saying is the density is already established in the comp plan as to the hubs.
Mm-hmm.
What we're really looking at are the rest of the AB, zoned AB and AB2 properties. We're not trying to establish hubs. We're trying to cover the rest of the pink areas.
She's concerned that if by
the
changing
corridor.
The
okay, so we're not talking about any of these circles. We're just talking about a random piece of property
right.
zoned AB and what they can do with it.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's correct.
AB or NC or OP.
Or AB2.
Or AB2. It's a conditional use right now, up to 12 units an acre.
Not designing the hubs.
And the point is that all of pink right. could, on a boom, de facto boom. Level, become hubs.
That's my concern.
Well, yes. And, I mean, historically, we have seen this go on for years. Now they would do it this way. What they used to do is they would just come to the commission and ask for a rezone.
Right.
I own a piece of property. It's AB or it's AB2, and I would like it to be R1. And then they could put in,
right.
you know,
but now,
a development in 10 houses.
But under our current zone, as long as they put some commercial on the ground floor, they can have 12
okay.
residential
mm-hmm.
anywhere that pink is. And that's what we're looking at.
No, in my opinion, we need to protect our commercial zoning.
Exactly
yes.
my point.
Okay.
Exactly.
So,
my
yeah,
point.
Well, my talking about workforce just has to do with the hubs, which is...
Well, I think even if you wanted to put a smaller number of residential units, I would say four, but I mean, I'm not going to die over a number.
No, because the thing is, if you look at it from a financial basis, going forward, Mount Pleasant needs commercial. Already today, what a residential customer pays in taxes and fees...
No, I agree with you.
Is not covering the cost of providing those services.
And that's what I said earlier, that it costs the town for residential.
Yes.
And commercial developers make more on residential, so they, you don't, so if we restrict it to workforce, I don't think it will incentivize developers to put a lot of residential on those AB zones, because they'll, as long as we extend the term of workforce housing, you know, from 10 years to something more substantial, I don't think that they will be as inclined to start sticking residential in all those places, because if it's workforce, they don't make as much money off of it.
Right.
So that's why I think I'm okay with putting, as long as it's workforce, to putting a few units in all the rest of that pink area. Not 12, not, you know, six seems high to me too, but, you know, I don't want to die over the number.
Mr. Davis?
Yeah, thank you. So, you know, listening to all this conversation and also thinking about the last planning meeting when we talked about the STRs and so forth, it just seems to me that we deal in a lot of random numbers. You know, is 6 the right number? Is 8 the right number? Is 10 the right number? You know, what is the right number? It had to do with the, you know, the length of the stays in the short-term rentals, where we, is 120, is it this, you know, we just seem to deal with a lot of random, and even today at the meeting today, you know, should it be 6, should it be 12? And I think what we need to do is to, and I agree with Joseph, I just think that we need to define and maybe do some more research and maybe look at other towns our size to see how they handle this, because, you know, just picking numbers at random, you know, 6, 12, 15, 24, 36, 50, I mean, it doesn't make any sense to me. I'm an accountant by education, and I deal with numbers all the time. And, you know, I just think that before we decide on a final number and on any particular given situation, we just need to be careful about it, you know, not make decisions too quickly, although we don't want to wait, you know, we don't want to wait forever to make decisions either, but maybe make some comparisons with other towns approximately the same size as ours.
Okay.
And see what others are doing, so that we're not really dealing in random numbers, we're dealing with we'll say better educated numbers when we make these final decisions.
Okay.
Anybody else? So is it this board to bring it back to our next meeting?
That's my preference, Judge.
So,
okay. So at the August regular meeting, we'll come back with more examples, more data.
Yeah.
And then I'll provide an update to the committee at their August meeting.
With the recommendations we'll, that we're considering. And, mm-hmm.
Yeah, it seems discussed. To me that we're on board with all of the things other than just the specific number of workforce mm-hmm. housing units to go in the AB zone.
Okay.
Good. Well, thanks. Thanks for bringing that up. Next is item 7B, Engineering Development Services.
Deferred from last month.
Good evening. Good afternoon, members of the Planning Commission. Special presentation here. We do this every so often. Just basically give you an overview of our development process from the bigger picture of what goes into on the public sector, what we do internally before it comes to you guys, and then what takes place after it leaves y'all's decision-making process. And we have the newest member of our Environmental Engineering Division, Ms. Julie Wright, here. She's making her first appearance, so I just want to put her on the spot a little bit. But she comes to us from College of Charleston. She's got a master's in marine and environmental science. So she's right now our design review team coordinator. And but we'll be expanding on her skills and using her educational expertise, hopefully, in the future. So you'll be seeing her a little bit more often in the future.
What is her name?
Miss Julie Wright. Ms. Julie Wright.
And Julie Wright's always right.
Yeah, she'll, we worked on her projection of her voice, so we'll see if she's able to project her voice a little bit today. But anyway, go ahead.
Thank you. Okay, so I'm Julie Wright. I'm the Development Review Team, or DRT Coordinator. I oversee the entire DRT process, from communicating with the applicant and getting their submittal, to facilitating our internal and external DRT meetings, just coordinating with all of our DRT staff members to make sure we have a good review. And so I'm going to be going over the entire residential review process, kind of like for sketch plans. And hopefully this gives you a feel for where DRT has a role, where you have a role, and what kind of happens after, after you see it. So first I'll go over what the DRT is and why we have it and who makes it up and yeah, all of that. So it was created in January of 2020 as a collective effort between all of our departments to improve the quality of review, encourage cross-training, minimize lost time, and streamline comments. It makes up all of the departments up there. They're kind of all of our staff that you can think of as like the subject matter experts in their area of their review. So planning and zoning, landscape and trees, floodplain, Mount Pleasant Waterworks, fire, transportation, water quality, stormwater, and public services. Now, we don't look at all of everything that comes in, but it's mainly those larger projects. And we do meet monthly to go over all of our agenda items, all of our projects that we're seeing, and just to discuss and make sure there's no conflicts between each other's review. So now I'll go through the process. There's 8 steps, and you can see Planning Commission is the 3rd step. The blue is all of the DRT steps, and the red is everything that comes after. So first we have the DRT feasibility meeting. This is where someone might have an idea and they want to just ask us our opinion and if it's going to be feasible for them. So we'll give them comments and answer any questions. And then once they decide they want to follow through with it, they'll go to the conceptual review, which is a DRT review, just a little bit more in detail than the feasibility meeting. And just internally, we meet, give comments back, and then the next step is when they come to Planning Commission. DRT also reviews it, and you will give, if you approve or deny, and then it will go to the technical review phase, which is internal again. We just go back and forth with the applicant to work out some of the details, like stormwater calculations or anything of that nature. So that can last a few months, and then next, once everything's ironed out, we give our DRT approval, so I'll stamp the plans and give it back to them. Then it will go to the infrastructure and final plat phase, which is the where all the field construction inspections for infrastructure take place, and the subdivision becomes final with the final plat. Once each parcel in the subdivision is ready to be built on, they will apply for the single-family residential site and tree review. And this is concurrent with building inspections review. So they will do inspections, review the site, all of that. And once they are fine with it, the building permit will be released and they can start construction. So as you can see, oh yeah.
All right, while you're there, when you say construction, when can they like clear the land? What part is it? After the tree review, when can they start disturbing the land, I guess?
They're able to get a clearing and grading permit following your DRT approval. So that's when they start implementing the infrastructure. And then from there, we'll move it through the inspection process. That number 6 right there, we could spend a couple of hours talking about all the details and everything that goes into the oversight It's involved with building a road and a drainage system, pond and all that, protecting trees. But yeah, once they have the DRT approval, that means that the MS4 letter goes to DHEC, and they're able to get the clearing and grading permit once they put the silt fence and tree protection up. So they're able to move forward after number five.
Okay. Thanks.
That was mainly my presentation. I just wanted to emphasize where you all fall in the process. I think give you a better idea.
Okay.
And just one little further note, Ms. Smith, this is just for residential. The commercial, if you substitute planning commission with DRB,
exactly.
And Mr. Stone's here too, he can answer any questions for DRB, but that's generally the same general process.
Here's my concern in the process. It seems to me that sometimes we get sketch plans that come before us that I feel have inadequate information for us to approve them. Like, for example, there's no tree study. So who makes the decision to send a sketch plan to the commission that is kind of missing crucial bits of information?
we do try our best to work with the applicants, and a lot of times they will have some information that might not fit all the checklist items but could not be relevant to the actual request at hand. But if you feel that is relevant and the Planning Commission feels that information needs to be provided at the next meeting. But those missing items are part of staff comments.
Right.
And as noted, when we present these things, these are the missing items, but they're on the agenda for whatever reasons, we're trying to work with the applicant and the developer, and, there's 90 days to get a surveyor to do anything right now.
Right.
So,
So I guess.
So those are the elements we're working with: the political elements and the constructability and the market elements, and then we're trying to provide the service that they want to provide. But it's under y'all's purview to actually say, we need this information answered. You need to come back next month and either defer it or not.
I have in the past. I have tilted in the direction of, if something that concerns me is also noted in the staff comments, I feel like, okay.
Proof conditionally.
Yes.
Right.
And so the question, I guess my final question is, if we do approve conditionally, based on staff comments, does that give you sufficient clout as you work your way through these steps to make sure those things happen?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
I really appreciate the ability for Planning Commission to make notes of these specific staff comments and whatever concerns that they have, because it becomes part of the minutes. And many months down the road, when they actually do want to do something, they come back before us and it's in part of the minutes. And that's what I and other folks, they go to, and I forward those minutes, highlight, this is what Ms. Smith said, we need tree survey and we need, the evaluation there before it moves forward, where is it? So that really helps us when things are part of the minutes and noted and in the meeting and discussed like that. So yeah, we really appreciate that.
All right.
And just quickly, giving your question, the line of question that reminded me, I really applaud your having boosted the expectations with respect to the stormwater management plan. I think that's gone a long way to addressing some of our questions, the recurring questions that we had.
So much better than it was, say, three, four years ago.
Right.
So,
my only question is partially legal, I guess, but my understanding is that vested rights accrue when the sketch plan is approved. Is that right?
Yes.
So if we approve a sketch plan, but there's still a number of things that are missing that are in the staff comments, and we say it's conditioned upon those, but those never come back to us. They're going to be reviewed just by you.
Correct.
Have we basically given vested rights, or
I don't believe so.
Okay. I think we need to be really clear on that so that it's not vested until they've completed.
David.
Oh, sure.
Got to be part of the record.
I was ready to start talking away. You know, as Kevin said about item number six, there's an hours-long discussion about vested rights. And I will tell you, over the years, we get into a multitude of disputes about vested rights. We're involved, I believe, in three legal cases right now where it's the issue. And this is my gripe. The state statute's unclear, which means our ordinance is unclear. And there's precious little court history to determine that. So I think, you know, over the years, we've been looking for a push as to define in our ordinance, which I think we can. There's always the question of whether we're overriding state law, but where we can definitively say that. And of course, we take the position that if it is conditional, and that's why I'm always advocating when you add those conditions, that the right does not vest until those conditions are met. And I think we're legally correct. The problem is, and this is my, judges just don't understand that. And I'm sorry to say, but I've never been in a court, not once, where I've had a judge understand the concept of vested rights. So it's a perception issue as much as it is a legal issue.
So because of that reality and the fact that judges don't really see the light that we think they should see, wouldn't it be better to not bring the sketch plan to be approved until we have at least certain fundamental things because of that nuance that might get missed?
So you're saying that a condition, are you saying that on a conditional situation that it's conditioned and it's left to staff, but at some point for final approval, it needs to come back?
Right.
Yeah, I think that if we spell, you know, I certainly want to talk to staff as to the practicality of that, but from a legal standpoint,
we are the
that's
function.
The way to do it.
Well, because we are the sort of the sayer of whether it's approved.
It's so impractical.
Yeah.
Well, you know,
because depending on what plot of land and where it is, okay, you can have serious drainage issues that it's really not fair to or even possible to resolve them all that early in the process. And the same thing, you know, like with certain tree issues and stuff. And so I think if, aside from the when does the vested rights thing start, if we approve a sketch plan because overall it meets things. It's not requiring, you know, LDR waivers or anything else like that. And we make it conditional on issues that staff has already made note of in their notes. I mean, I think that's the appropriate thing to do.
Which is, I'm sorry, what is the appropriate thing?
To approve the sketch plan conditionally.
Right.
I mean, there are times when we don't, but that's because, well, I can only speak for myself.
Yeah.
It is because a sketch plan comes before me and it is missing all sorts of stuff, but there's no staff notes, which tells me, I mean, sometimes, I mean, the cynic in me, I do know that you can't get your financing until you've got an approved sketch plan and, you know, they want to get to the bank and get the money. Well, I'm sorry. You know, it's not my problem.
I'll be happy to give a shot at this. That particular topic you're on is when it becomes compliant and when it doesn't become compliant and there's more information that's needed. Our sketch plans, like they have, we have different sketch plans for sketch plan checklist, and then we have the technical review checklist. If the applicant meets all the sketch plan checklist, that's all they're required to do at that particular time before they get to the planning commission. And if there's further study that's needed from a technical perspective, then that comes at the next level of their development review process. So I think the sketch plan kind of is the key to what information really is required at that particular meeting. And, you know, we can always revisit what's required at the sketch plan level. But the checklist itself, that I believe would be, in my opinion, the deciding factor whether or not it really becomes vested once you complete that sketch plan checklist and you receive a favorable vote from the planning commission, then that's all the requirements that's being asked from the applicant to receive the sketch plan. Now, once it moves to the next step, then you have the technical review, and they have a different set of checklist items that they have to meet. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that helps or what, but, you know, as far as, like, if they're missing the tree survey, which is on a sketch plan checklist,
yeah,
then the sketch plan checklist is, the application really is technically incomplete.
I
until
would
they,
prefer
until
not
they
to
finish
be
that.
Asked to approve things until we've got those things done because of the vesting. I don't want to end up with a plan that we end up in court and somebody says they're vested, but we didn't intend them to be because they didn't complete something.
I agree. And it's compounded by the fact that up until, was it 2 years ago, 3 years ago, we used to get the preliminary plat. So we always felt like
we'd had enough done.
Yeah, or as Joseph used to put it, you know, another bite out of the apple.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it's like,
yeah,
wait
that's
a
right.
second, we thought you were going to put sidewalks
right,
in,
right.
and you didn't,
yeah.
or
no,
why
I
are
agree.
You planning on removing all those trees? But now, it's yeah. like the sketch plan, and then...
I agree. I think if we're not going to get two bites at the apple, then I do think we're taking too much of a risk, even though we might, I think we should still clarify our ordinance about vested rights, but I still think we should be able to get everything on the checklist for the sketch plan done before we approve it.
Instead of making recommendations.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Just say, hey, we deny it based
and
on
that may not
this,
be what
this.
Developers want, but I mean, that's what their job is to get those things done.
Just one final piece, if it helps you with your decision. I did grumble about the ineffectiveness of the courts, and that's a gripe that judges don't hear this. But as a practical matter, I assure you, in any time the town, me, goes before a court, a judge is going to provide that applicant the benefit of the doubt 90 times over. It happens every time. We will never be provided the benefit of the doubt. Right. So any opportunity to make it cleaner and clearer, even though it is additional work, my opinion is that is a benefit to the town of Mount Pleasant.
I agree.
How often are you having to go to court to represent us in those kinds of conflicts?
Well, every major development case that we've had over the past, let's see, 12 years that I've been general counsel have involved in some form vested rights. And this is public. I don't want to talk too much about a pending case except for claims that have been made, but you all are very familiar with the current litigation related to the Boutique Hotel. And their claim in that specific case is that just the fact that the DRT heard the issue, even though a vested right that is not granted therefrom, they're claiming that DRT's comments is equivalent to a vested right. And I'll publicly say it's absurd.
Yeah.
It's an absurd comment. Of course, the fear is that we do exactly what happens when we go before the courts. And these issues, they hear car wreck cases and slip and falls every day. and these issues are not in their wheelhouse. And so... As much as I'd love to tell you we are legally correct, and we are,
mm-hmm.
I have no way of, with any confidence, saying that those matters get resolved fairly and properly.
Like you said, you've got one hand tied behind your back just
yeah.
because we're the town and not the applicant.
Correct.
The reason for my question, obviously, I mean, it's not to be nosy as much as I guess it's public record, but it's really trying to get a better sense as to how recurrent that challenge is and what we can do to, you know, shore up the process
yeah.
so that you have that much more to support the argument, you know?
Sure. We're right. That is a good way. We walk into the courtroom regardless with the severe burden of that. And so whatever can be done, in my opinion, to help clarify that, I would certainly be in favor of, notwithstanding the fact that staff is probably looking at me sideways considering more work. But it is an issue and one that I've struggled with over the years, and it's the same.
If we deny, is it a circle and it goes back to number two?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's a good question.
Yes, ma'am. For the reasons stated in the meeting, they address the reasons, then they can present another sketch plan to you. There's been one on, I know it's come back before you before five times.
Sketch plans are exempt from having to wait a year thing, aren't they?
Sketch plans are exempt. Do they have the, do they?
I don't think they have a...
No, I don't believe they do.
Do it immediately.
I've seen sketch plans that have come back similar to the previous month's sketch plan that have addressed comments and either been denied or deferred and come back to you within a month or two.
Mr. President, and don't want to put you on the spot, and if you don't want to answer, you don't have to, but say if we deny something that, you know, comment type thing too, and it goes back to you, roughly, what is the time frame? If I'm an applicant, it gets denied, I come to you, I supposedly fix it to your department. Is that a weeks? Is that months?
Usually the deadline for the next meeting is around that meeting.
Oh, so it's
date.
Based on when they
so
put it in.
It's based on the deadline. Okay. So if they can meet the deadline, then they can be, they can have that returned. But typically it's a month gap in between just because they need to go fix it and then submit for the next.
I mean, I realize that the two bites of the apple was probably eliminated, and this is before my time, but it was probably eliminated because it was seemed burdensome and there were too many things coming before. Is that?
I think, and I'm speaking, thanks, Kevin was here too. I think it, there was some people that got caught in the weeds a lot with some technical issues that we didn't have the expertise to get into.
There was
on the plat level.
Yeah, there was redundancy, and then there was someone who I remember.
Yeah, we made a presentation. Really, we made a presentation on that.
The merging over there in the back.
Number of,
I think you know who I'm.
The unintended consequences of coming back the second time is that the first time gives them leverage for the second approval.
And they have
you're basically have different levels of approval where they feel, I guess by right, maybe, I don't know what they call it, but by right, they should go ahead and have that second approval because they made it through the first approval. So there's an unintended consequence.
So I guess the important thing is that the first approval that comes to us, which would in this case be the sketch plan, has to be as complete as possible or we deny
it. In the areas that are important.
Well, in other words, just rather than just saying conditioned on, you know, completing what's in the staff comments, we shouldn't send it back with that approval for the reason that it was pointed out. We should not see it until those things have been done.
So
that we can approve it with those things done.
That was basically what I was going to ask David. It sounds like we should not approve anything conditionally, but instead just send it, deny it, recognizing that the applicant can, you know, make some amends with the
staff
and
then
bring it back.
That's what you want to do if you're afraid about when do vested rights start.
And this is the key is we need to be careful about rights vesting. That's the key. Then they get all the.
Is there logic in my statement, David?
It's entirely. I'm my wheels are turning with that as to whether that's appropriate. Again, legally, I don't want to be guilty of advising you all to say that there's a legal problem because I'm very comfortable where we stand on a legal basis.
Practical.
It's just practical, and you know the bringing back for to counter that. I would suggest that I think the overall idea of the preliminary plat and then moving on was a good one, because then, and again, this isn't pointed directly, it's more of a, I think we saw some very difficult decisions going the other way with overreach by our planning commission, quite honestly, denying things for reasons and basis that are not relevant. And so, you know, we get, I don't want to compare and say we get in more legal trouble, but we get in a significant amount of legal trouble for technical issues that in reality, it's unfair to be put in front of you.
Right.
You know, there's certain technical expertise that is staff dependent. So I think as a general matter, the conditional part is fine. I think we can strengthen the language in our ordinance. And, you know, at least when these issues arise, we just make a clear record that this is these conditions must be met. You know, perhaps that's the way to do it.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, and I might do it, Kevin, and I might have seen it. Will we have in our staff report or notes that all preliminary or all sketch items are complete, you know, and have guidance.
Yeah.
That way, not necessarily all the technical, because obviously they don't have to do that at that stage, but at the very least right. where they're at now.
So, and I don't have the language directly in front of me, but the vesting, you know, says approval. It should be final approval and after all conditions
right.
are met.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
Is that stated clearly in our documents?
No. I don't know that it is, but keep in mind, let's go back to the first statement I made. We have a state law that really is we follow, and the state law is not clear. I think our issue is, can we be more clear and not supersede state law? That seems to me to be the issue, and I do believe there's some room for clarification. Again, there's precious little guidance from state law and no guidance from our court systems on these issues. So, you know, it's one of those where we can probably be more bold and force a court to tell us that we can't do it would be
at least be clearer in ours.
Right.
Then, yeah. Mm-hmm. Can we make a note of doing that, like as one of the high priority items to come sure. before us, is to mm-hmm. fix the vesting language?
Yeah, you want to maybe cue this up maybe for next month, and we can put this out in the staff report and identify some of the areas and start working towards it. Maybe
yeah. Good.
Yeah. we can create yeah. a little workshop.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, anything we can do to minimize the amount of work David has to do in court
well,
is better.
Yeah.
to defend us, because we are right. It's just that it doesn't always matter.
Well, David gets paid the big bucks. So he gets paid by the hour. So, you know, I mean.
Well, then it's in our benefit to minimize what he does.
Yeah.
Well, not for the record, that big bucks is a relative term.
Yeah, exactly. He doesn't need workforce housing. Let's just put it
yeah,
that
yeah.
way.
Well, that's good. No, it's been very beneficial. I appreciate good. You putting good. This together, Julie and Kevin, and things like this, and touching base and being proactive about it, because it really does helps the process, no matter how many times we've been through it,
yeah.
kind of clear code and so forth.
Julie.
Yep.
Yeah.
Great
yeah.
job. Anything else?
Nothing.
See you nothing further. We are adjourned. Thanks all.
Nice job, Julie.
A little heaven yellow in the corner.